Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 776. My name is Camden Busey. I'm in Libertyville, Illinois, as usual, and back and excited to have another episode lined up. We're going to be talking about Presbyterian history. Of course, it's been on my mind a lot, and love doing more and more of these episodes, digging in, of course, into our favorite era, the early 20th century in America. And to do that, we have with us a return guest, Jeff McDonald, who's the pastor of Avery Presbyterian Church in Belleville, Nebraska. He's the author of John Gerstner and the Renewal of Presbyterian and Reformed Evangelicalism in Modern America, which we spoke about 3 years ago, I believe, and also the author of a new article that we're going to be speaking today that covers some topics regarding Machen. But welcome to the program, Jeff. It's good to see you again.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you so much, Camden, for having me.
You bet. I should let the listener know that we just reconnected last week. It seems a long time ago now. A lot has happened. It's been a busy fall. But down in Wheaton College, one of your alma maters, and we're able to attend the Presbyterian Scholars Conference, which I've mentioned on this program before. But I can't say enough about that small little event. I just love it. I've been 2 years in a row. Thank you for the invitation. But it's spectacular. I'm wondering if you could let people know about this event, kind of how it came about and, you know, how it has, you know, evolved, I suppose, or has come to its present form.
Yeah, started in 2015, and I just looked around and I couldn't find, you know, too many conferences that deal with Presbyterian history. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of different conferences that are larger. There's some that focus on Reformation history, but you know, there weren't really any that I could find that dealt with kind of modern 20th century Presbyterian history. So we started in 2015, and Don McLeod, who's a Canadian Presbyterian historian, helped me get it off the ground, and we've been meeting now every year since, and we've had you know, a lot of good papers on Presbyterian history, a lot of you know, really good book panels. We try to mix it up, you know, with you know, early career scholars, yeah, mid-career and more senior scholars. We try to do that, and we also try to mix up the denominational affiliation.
Oh yeah, that's what's fun. That all of it's very fun, but that's an interesting component.
Yeah, we just feel like you know, bringing different denominational traditions into the discussion is really important to get the different perspectives on Presbyterian history. And so we, you know, I've had, you know, OPC, PCUSA, EPC, Presbyterian Church in Canada, PCA, Reformed Presbyterian speaker. So we've tried to mix it up and get different voices there.
Mm-hmm. And even, you know, it's fascinating about some of the listed names of people that have come and delivered in the past. And you know, the two times I've been there, we've had Mark Knoll and George Marsden, Brad Gundlach, Bradley Longfield, a whole host of people. Danny Olinger's presented, Daryl Hart. I don't want to leave people out, but I mean, it's you walk in and I'm just like a kid in a candy store, proverbially speaking, and get to just sit and listen to all these really fun presentations. But also, there are a lot of book panels. Can you describe the thought behind those? Because I think those are some of the richest opportunities to hear people talk and interact regarding their ideas.
Yeah, the book panels have been a big, you know, part of it, and a lot of good discussion, really stimulating discussion. And we try to have panels on, you know, books that people are interested in, and we try to have different perspectives presented on those panels too, so that creates, I think, a good discussion. I think we saw that last week with some of the
almost had a fist fight break. It was a lively discussion, and for good reason, but that was a fun discussion. We were talking about some things. Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, and that's what we want. We want to have you know, lively discussion. Sure. And not just have, you know, panelists that are just all of the same perspective, or yeah, just, you know, praising the book. There need, you know, we want critique, and that's important.
Yeah, I appreciate that. So we'll typically have a relatively recent book, or maybe there's a book that's an anniversary of a classic book that was published a while ago, and that author will be there, right? And then you coordinate with a few other scholars, so maybe three or four people might offer their critique and comment on the book in question. And then at the end, the author gets to respond to all of them. And then after that, anyone who's there can offer their comments or ask any questions. I find that that's just tremendous. It's really fun. It's kind of the way scholarship ought to proceed, that people can offer those open comments and then you can interact with those ideas.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's fun. It's doing it all in person too is really exciting, rather than just there's a place for print, and that's really important, especially for longevity. But being able to do that and then go have dinner with someone is pretty fun.
Yeah. I think one of the strongest, parts of the conference is just the fellowship part of it. And we want to, even increase that in the future and make opportunities for fellowship. But that's one of the things that we receive, is just people really enjoy the interaction, the opportunity to talk to people.
Yeah, I agree. Well, we can provide more information on that if people are interested. You can write in to us, at least. We can pass things on to Jeff if people would like. We're at mail@reformedforum.org. Is there any other way other than us forwarding inquiries to you, Jeff, where if people were interested or had some thoughts about this, where they might follow up?
Yeah, they could, you can email me at jsmcdonald47@gmail.com.
Okay. You asked for it.
Yeah, please email if you'd like to come.
No, that's good. That would be fun. We hope maybe we'll see some new faces next time. And has every conference been held at Harbor House at Wheaton College so far? Has that been the typical place?
Yeah, there was one in 2015. We actually had two conferences in 2015. And the first one was in March, and that was at the Harbor House. And then Wheaton College moved us to a different location.
Okay.
But all the other ones have been at the Harbor House.
But they've been at Wheaton.
Yeah.
Okay. Great. Well, maybe we'll see some new people next year. Looking forward to that. That's going to be exciting. Well, today we're looking to speak about Jeff's recent article, which is titled "Advancing the Evangelical Mind: Melvin Grove Kyle, J. Gresham Machen, and the League of Evangelical Students." I linked to this in a previous episode of Crisis Center. Jeff, this has not been published yet, the previous episode, but we're out of time here because we record and it takes some time for these podcasts to come out. But this is an open access article published by, I'm not exactly certain, the article itself says Religions, and it's through MDPI. Maybe you can offer some insight into this open access venue. But the article is fully available in full text online or as a PDF, and there'll be a link to that in the episode description. But Jeff, tell us about this publication and tell us a little bit about when it came out, just this summer, right?
2021.
Oh, last summer. Yeah.
And Religions is just an academic online journal. And I received an email from Randall Ballmer, who's a professor of religion at Dartmouth College. And he was publishing a special series in the journal on new directions in evangelical scholarship. And so I had some work on Kyle and Machen and the League of Evangelical Students. And I sent them to him, and he published it. So very thankful to Randall and the other editors as well.
Absolutely. No, it's very high quality. Not just the piece itself, but the journal. And I'm glad to have found it. I should have known about it before, but I'm glad through you to get this. And I just love the idea of open access, that we're able to put this out in a scholarly way, but yet in a way where it's freely accessible to people who would like to learn and grow in their understanding. So I have heard about some of these organizations that Machen had been involved in. We're going to be speaking mostly about Melvin Grove Kyle, but the overlap here with J. Gresham Machen, of course, a figure that is well known to our particular audience. But I wonder if you could set the stage for us a little bit, as every good historian should do when we're introducing the subject of study. What context are we speaking about here, and lead us on into this interaction between Machen, Melvin Grove Kyle, a biblical archaeologist, and this student group that they founded jointly.
Yeah, well, Machen, you know, obviously is well known for founding the OPC and the Independent Presbyterian Board of Foreign Missions, and for founding Westminster Seminary. Mm-hmm. But another, you know, organization that he founded was the League of Evangelical Students. And so this paper goes into his work in that organization and what he was trying to accomplish. And, you know, in the course of, you know, research on it, I, you know, discovered, you know, that he had relationships with United Presbyterian scholars and had gone to St. Louis on a couple of occasions. I think he went both times with Robert Dick Wilson and visited Xenia Seminary. So there was, you know, there was relationships that were being built there in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. And so Machen and Princeton Seminary students founded this organization. And then they asked Melvin Grove Kyle, the president of Xenia Seminary, to also be on the board. And so Machen and Kyle were the two president, the two Presbyterians on the board.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a bit about Xenia and the UPs. I was born into the UPC USA. I was a covenant child. So this is only a few years before the PC USA, as we now know it, was formed when it merged with the PC US. So there's a bit of UP history in me somehow in crossing my biography. But Xenia, if I'm not mistaken, is the oldest Presbyterian seminary, isn't it? It was late 18th century, but
1794.
Yeah, there you go. But not too many people necessarily know Machen's interactions or Machen's overlap with Xenia, or here even with the League of Evangelical Students. But why do you think this is somewhat of a maybe not forgotten part of Presbyterian history, but certainly one that hasn't received as much attention as we might expect?
Well, one thing is that it's a little bit confusing. First of all, the mainline church from 1958 mm-hmm. to 1983 was called the UPC-USA.
Yeah.
And so in 58, it added the U because they were able to get a smaller Presbyterian denomination, which was the UPC-NA,
to
join UPC-USA. And so that created the UPC-USA. So there's just that confusion, you know, that's added to it. And so mm-hmm. I think some people, you know, don't realize that there was this earlier United Presbyterian Church.
Yes.
That was about 10% of the size of the mainline church in 1958. And so mm-hmm. the UPC-NA, you know, just has its own traditions, its own history, its own type of scholarship. And so what happened, I think, in the mid-1920s, you know, from the evidence that we have, is that when Machen and the Princeton Seminary students founded the League of Evangelical Students, they really couldn't find any other PCUSA seminary presidents or administrators to support it. Mm-hmm. But Machen was able to find a United Presbyterian seminary president to support the League of Evangelical Students, and that's Melvin Grove Kyle.
Mm-hmm. What is Melvin Grove Kyle's background? You speak of him. He's a scholar, a very well known, accomplished scholar, with the president of a seminary. But he's coming up as a biblical archaeologist. Speak a bit about that discipline, especially at this particular time in history. It's an interesting development and adds some color to this story here.
Well, yeah, in the late 19th, early 20th century, the United Presbyterian Church of North America had very strong missions and was involved in a lot of, you know, missionary engagement. In fact, it had the highest per capita giving to missions of any American denomination. And the one of the places where the United Presbyterians were very strong in was in Egypt. Hmm. And so Kyle was a UP pastor in Philadelphia, and his church members were going to Egypt and doing missions work, and he was going there, and he was on the missions board for the UP church. And so he developed this interest in biblical archaeology, and with archaeologists from the University of Pennsylvania. And they actually asked him to do archaeological research there. And that really developed into a career for him. And he became one of the first, or one of the early, you know, biblical archaeologists, and did excavations there with some of the greatest names in the whole history of, you know, Near Eastern archaeology. But he remained, you know, a very conservative Protestant, and you know, a very strong defender of the faith. And he tried to influence, Kyle tried to influence, you know, famous archaeologists. And one of the most famous that he influenced was William Foxwell Albright, who became really the dean of biblical archaeologists and was a longtime professor at Johns Hopkins. And Albright started out his career as a radical skeptic of the Bible, but through his relationship with Kyle, he came to a more centrist position.
Interesting. Well, Kyle, this whole story, you know, as you write in this article, is that this study is important because it helps us grasp how evangelical Protestantism rehabilitated and advanced itself intellectually. Tell us a bit about this period and why that was an important project. I think that helps us to get us into the mind of Kyle and Machen a little bit in terms of their purpose for this organization. But what is significant about the culture, and why was it a struggle for, how were Christians, I should say, being marginalized intellectually?
Yeah, so I think in the mainline denominations, liberal theology was becoming, you know, stronger, and it was taking over seminaries, and you know, secular education was just really, you know, advancing throughout the academy. And so Machen and these Princeton seminary students, they were upset with an inter-seminary group that was that they were a part of, that was promoting, you know, liberal biblical scholarship and more liberal theology. And so they did not want to be a part of that anymore. And so they separated and created this organization, you know, the League of Evangelical Students. And so I think, you know, what if you look at the magazine for the league, you know, they are promoting, you know, different scholars, they're promoting different articles on different theological and, you know, topics. And so, and they're also promoting a lot of books in there. So this is an effort by Machen and Kyle and others to, you know, help students and different people to, you know, to develop Christian minds and to be encouraged as, you know, undergraduates or graduate students, you know, in their work. And they were trying to show that, you know, modern scholarship has not made conservative Christianity untenable. So they're pushing back, you know, very hard against that.
What kind of activities were they involved in? I mean, are there, I guess I should also ask, are there any antecedents to this organization, or competing student groups who are like the League of Anti-Evangelical Students or something? Where does this come from, this idea, this germ of starting a student group? And what did they do at it?
Well, I know the colleges had the, you know, the YMCA student, you know, groups. There's other Christian ministries, you know, on campuses. But this was really a more conservative effort because, you know, Protestantism was being split between more liberal and conservative factions. And so, you know, Machen is really trying to get as many people involved in this as possible. And I think the group goes from in 1925, I think they had, you know, just a few on a few campuses, and by the late 30s, they're on 60 campuses. So, so the group, the organization really did grow. They had chapters at all sorts of different colleges, Christian colleges, state universities, many Ivy Leagues, you know, universities had a chapter of the League of Evangelical Students. They had regional conferences. They had a national conference every year. And so Machen was traveling to different, local chapters, but also he went to regional chapters and he spoke at many of the national conventions.
You know, as I'm digging through presently, you know, thoughts and researching Ned Stonehouse. Ned Stonehouse was really, the junior colleague to Machen at Westminster in New Testament. And then when Machen passed away, Stonehouse carried on, not all, but a lot of his labors and work, and became a key figurehead in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. But I found the more I'm studying, you know, that Stonehouse and Machen seem to have more similar ideas about ecumenical involvement and a breadth of that. They're both very strong confessionalists, so they're not compromising on their confession or the theology at all. But they still approach, they have a different, it's hard to, for me to put my finger on this. And as my research is developing, you know, you're tossing out ideas and thinking through things. So these are all, a lot of these are nascent thoughts, but they have a different posture than maybe some of the other folks in the OPC, early OPC, like John Murray and Cornelius Van Til, R.B. Kuyper, other heroes of mine. But it's interesting to see different ideas here. And Stonehouse is very much involved in early ecumenical efforts to get the OPC involved and connected to other churches. And some people didn't like Stonehouse's proposals. He thought they weren't as confessionally based as they ought to be, and they need to have stronger relations and ties through the confession. But my question here is your sense of things regarding Machen and his involvement. Machen was out there. He's a busy guy and he's involved in all sorts of different things. And it's interesting for me to see this, especially in 1925. There's plenty for him to be involved with at Princeton. I mean, they're going through all sorts of studies and investigations and looking into all sorts of stuff formally, but yet he's still out there speaking at different conferences, starting new organizations and being involved with a wider range of people, not just UPs, but Baptists, all sorts of fundamentalists too. What, you know, as a student of and historian of evangelicalism in America, I mean, is this typical? Is Machen unique? What do you think, do you have any thoughts on his involvement and what this particular student group might, or this particular effort with Kyle might disclose about him?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things they talked about in the obituary that appeared in the organization's magazine was that Machen, that students were close to his heart, that he loved students, and he would send free books, you know, to students. There was an offer in the magazine that Machen would send, you know, we'll send you these books if you just send your name. And so I think he just really, you know, cared about people. He cared about their spiritual development, and he didn't want people, students, to be intimidated, you know, by unbelieving professors or, you know, liberal critics, you know. So, you know, what's interesting about this organization that he started is that many of the next generation, you know, some of the best conservative Protestant scholars, you know, really come out of this organization that Machen started. So I think that's, you know, another contribution of his in terms of shepherding, you know, students and but also I think, you know, organizing different professors across the country to support, you know, a lot of the critique that he had against, you know, liberal Protestantism. And that's what we see in the different articles, you know, all sorts of different professors who are lining up against modernist scholarship.
Certainly. Do you find a similar motivation for Melvin Grove Kyle that he also saw? I guess I'm wondering how they partnered up together, not just circumstantially, but did they see something in each other mutually that drew them to be co-laborers together? I guess, you know, maybe it's a question that can't be answered, but why these two at this point in time with this particular endeavor? Is it just happen? Are they hanging with each other on conference circuit and had a late night and decided, hey, let's start a student group, or what's going on here with these two figures?
Yeah, I think Machen, you know, was aware of these United Presbyterian scholars. Some of them, you know, going back a decade before this, had been involved in the Bible League. I think it was the Bible League of America, and they had a magazine. And so you see Kyle appearing on the pages there, along with, you know, Benjamin Warfield. And so they had some, you know, they had some type of relationship. But when I looked at, you know, the Xenia Seminary catalogs from the 1920s, that's where I discovered that Machen actually had been going to Xenia to present relationships, to present papers. So I don't know. I'm assuming that's how those relationships, you know, really developed more. But I haven't found any correspondence between Kyle and Machen.
Yeah, I wonder. I wonder what might be out there. It might be a question for Daryl Hart at some point to see if he recalls anything of the sort. The Machen archives, even just at Westminster, are just massive. It'd be nice if those were digitized and cataloged, but there's, you know, maybe we can find a donor who'd be willing to fund that effort for Westminster, so that the likes of you and I can read those from a distance. That would be a great benefit to scholarship, but it's just very intriguing to me to think about Machen's interaction here, not only with Kyle, but also with Xenia Seminary. You know, you write that Kyle Machen and the LES challenged evangelicals to take the life of the mind seriously, and their work laid the foundation for a resurgent evangelicalism that was increasingly intellectually engaged. In what ways do we see that coming out of, you know, the mid-20s? What type of appreciable effect did this league have on students? And you mentioned some of the key figures coming on. Who were some of those folks, and what did they end up doing as engaged evangelicals?
Yeah, I mean, there's just many of that next generation were involved in this organization. You know, George Eldon Ladd at Fuller Seminary, professor there, he was on the executive student committee for this organization in, I think, 1932, I think is the dates. W. Stanford Reed was writing for this organization's journal. Vernon Grounds, who later became the longtime president of Denver Seminary, a Baptist, but that was someone, you know, who was, I think he was the vice president of the League of Evangelical Students, student vice president. And, you know, many others. Kenneth Conser, who became the leading, you know, dean of Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. He was converted at a League of Evangelical Students, ministry in that campus ministry there at Ashland College. So really some big name evangelicals of the next generation, were impacted by this effort.
What happened to the league over the years? Did it develop? Did it merge? Does it still exist? Can we join it?
No. Well, unfortunately, Kyle died in 1933, and so that was, you know, unfortunate. And I think if Kyle would have lived on, I think there would have been more United Presbyterian support for the league and for Machen. And then obviously Machen died January 1937. So that really hurt, you know, the league. It continued on for about five more years after Machen's death. And then it shut down, I think, in 1943. And I think part of it was that InterVarsity Christian Fellowship had, you know, come into the United States and was growing and gotten stronger. And so kind of superseded by that ministry. But this was kind of an early, somewhat like InterVarsity, somewhat like Campus Crusade type organization.
Yeah, that's interesting to me to think about this. We had on the program not too long ago, Arlen Migliazzo, who you had invited to our to the Presbyterian Scholars Conference last year, and he was able to present on his recent biography of Henrietta Mears. That's what we spoke with him about on the program, and it was fascinating to see Mears's leadership and influence on evangelicalism, but also her concern for young people and how many people, folks like Bill Bright, that came up through her ministry, so to speak, her efforts and her service in the church. I'm curious, do you think, did Mears have any involvement or awareness of the history of this organization, or do any of these other campus ministries or people involved in campus ministries, did they have any explicit knowledge of Kyle or Machen, or is this more or less just an historical, I don't know, something that kind of helped to set the stage, but something that wasn't explicitly in the mind of people that would come a few decades later?
Yeah, I'm not sure on the, I think Mears, you know, was probably aware of it, but I don't know. I wasn't really looking too much at her involvement. I don't think she was ever involved as far as I know, but she may have had some involvement. I would need to look at the chapters that existed, and let's see,
maybe there was one in Hollywood or something.
And then went out to Hollywood. Mm-hmm. I need to look at those years again. I know they did have a chapter at the University of Minnesota. There was a woman math professor there who was the faculty sponsor, and that group primarily was made up of women students at the University of Minnesota. And they invited Machen to the University of Minnesota to speak, and he did come.
Yeah.
And the report in the magazine was that there was four University of Minnesota professors that came to hear him speak. And I think there was either like, I think maybe 100 plus people in attendance. And there was a small Presbyterian church right on the border of the campus that was a strong supporter of the LES.
Man, the Gophers, the Golden Gophers are getting at it against liberalism. That's, you know, another thing that's interesting about this history and something you point out in the article is that this institution and its development and then its activities demonstrate really kind of a pan-Presbyterian descent from theological liberalism. Certainly that would extend beyond just Presbyterianism to other other traditions as well. But is this unique, do you think, in terms of institutions, or were there other examples of a pan-Presbyterian dissent or cooperation to fight against liberalism?
Yeah, well, let me just back up just one moment.
Sure.
The interesting thing about that church on the edge of the University of Minnesota campus is that it was pastored by one of Machen's former students, Evan Walsh. Evan Walsh, who became chaplain of Wheaton College later on. So that's kind of a little bit of interesting history there, too. There's been... Definitely there was United Presbyterians were very concerned about, the theological liberalism of the PCUSA. And in the early 1930s, they were able to reject a PCUSA effort to try to consolidate or merge the denominations. From what I can tell, I mean, there were, conservative Presbyterians, in the PCUSA and in the United Presbyterian Church and in these other denominations who worked together, maybe not necessarily a formal organization, but they were definitely, working together and had awareness of different things that were going on. And sometimes we see this in the different periodicals of that period. I think of the earlier Christian Today that Machen.
Oh yeah. Started. Craig's. Yeah.
And it's interesting. They were paying attention, to Kyle and what he was doing. And they have a large obituary in there about him. That's just one small thing, but
sure.
But I think this is one way that conservatives in the different Presbyterian denominations were able to come together and do something to oppose liberalism. Also on the board of the LES was William Childs Robinson, who was another former, Machen student. and then did a PhD at Harvard. And then he was for many years, he was a longtime professor of church history at Columbia Theological Seminary in the Presbyterian Church U.S.
Yeah, down south. My goodness. Yeah, that's important and significant. And I'm curious here, you know, if there's something, there seems to me something unique about campus ministry and the particular challenges of the young people have at college, you know, battling with ideas. And there, in many ways, it's a transitional phase in our culture for the folks that end up going off to, you know, undergraduate work or graduate work, that there's a particular need to bolster students and help them, kind of disciple them along, especially when they're being bombarded with all sorts of other ideas. So I definitely see the significance and the importance of a campus ministry. I myself benefited from one greatly. I was in Campus Crusade for Christ later in my undergraduate years, and that's where I met my wife. So I could say it did something for me. Do you get a sense that Kyle and others were, I don't know. Again, these are just hypothetical questions I'm just asking off the top of my head. But do you get a sense that they're looking at other opportunities, you know, seeking to create institutions? Or is this a unique instance? Machen was involved in lots of stuff, you know, in terms of the OPC. That became necessary in his mind when the PCUSA had proven to be, in their estimation, you know, a church that was not just anymore, not even following its own constitution, and not engaging in biblical discipline properly. So they're required to form another church. They had the Independent Board of Foreign Missions, and they thought that was necessary because the church was promoting modernism and engaging in missions that was saying Jesus Christ isn't the exclusive way to salvation. So that was necessary. You know, I could see how you're looking at, you know, the needs of Christian students. And if there isn't an organization providing for these particular people in their particular challenges, that they'd seek to develop an institution for that sort of thing. But is this just in the air? Is this unique to Machen? Is it unique to Kyle? Or is this something that many people were involved with? What are your sense of that? What is your sense of that in the early 20th century?
Yeah, well, I think Machen, you know, he was an institution builder, and I think this is, you know, this organization hasn't received as much attention as the other institutions that he's built. I think this is a significant organization. Most of the national conventions for the LES were held at, you know, seminaries or colleges, but there was one held, I think, in 1935 at Point Breeze Presbyterian Church. And I think that at that time, Akinge was the pastor of the church. And so it was kind of amazing that they would have one there. And then obviously, you know, he would go on to found other, you know, organizations and institutions or help lead them in the case.
Yeah, he's a pretty big name.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's definitely a legacy here. And, you know, I just think it's, you know, a legacy that deserves to be remembered. I think it shows that, you know, Machen's influence, it shows some of his influence in parts of church history that we may not be familiar with.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think he really did, you know, shape minds and influence people. One of the interesting people I came across in this study was the president of Hampton Sydney College, who had given Machen an honorary doctorate, and Machen had preached there. And this president, James Eggleston, had formerly been a materialist.
No.
He had previously been president of Virginia Tech, and then for many years was president of Hampton Sydney, and was a very strong Christian. But interestingly, you know, at that time when this president of Hampton Sydney was supporting the League of Evangelical Students, you know, one of the students at the college was Francis Schaeffer. So how much involvement did he have in this, you know?
Wow.
But I know that, you know, Schaeffer was reading Machen and was really inspired by Machen too. So
what's the, what do you think is the enduring legacy of Melvin Grove Kyle? on evangelical scholarship? And why, you know, do you think that we should revisit him or study him more often? And if so, you know, why and how?
Well, I think he's important because he was really one of the, you know, the best conservative Protestant biblical archaeologists in the early 20th century. He was really, you know, doing the hard work of going over to the Holy Land, doing the excavations, the, you know, writing them up, you know, working with many of the world's most famous, you know, archaeologists.
And I got to say, this is the era of Indiana Jones too, right?
Yes.
The fictional Indiana Jones, but a lot of that has to do with work that was being done at the University of Chicago at the time, back in the third early 20th century, 30s and on into the 40s and stuff. So it's interesting. He's a real life Indiana Jones.
He made Xenia Seminary a center for biblical archaeological, you know, scholarship, and the, you know, this Xenia merged with Pitt Xenia, then ultimately became Pittsburgh Seminary, and the biblical archaeology museum that Kyle started still exists today. As the Kelso Museum for Near Eastern Archaeology at Pittsburgh Seminary. So, you know, the other contribution of Kyle is that he was the revising editor of the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia that he worked on with James Orr, and that's really a United Presbyterian effort to get that. That's a massive 5-volume work, you know, published in 1915, and that Orr, you know, as I mentioned in this paper, literally worked himself to death, you know, to finish.
Goodness.
And I know Machen, you know, admired the ISB.
Mm-hmm.
I know that he really admired William Park Armstrong's article in there on New Testament chronology. So if anyone's interested in that, Wilbur Smith talks about Machen, you know, coming to his library one day and talking about the importance of that article and how significant it is. Mm-hmm. So
that's fascinating. What were you surprised at all when you were researching this article? I guess I should have asked to begin with, how did it come about? But as you're digging in and researching, did anything, you know, surprise you, or any unsuspecting facts arise that really caught you off guard?
I think what was most surprising to me, and what I would just encourage your listeners, you know, I think it shows just, you know, all the different relationships that Machen had with people that you might not realize. And it just shows the extent of really his ministry and what he was able to accomplish. And I think it shows, too, one of the things they talk about is just how Machen was willing, the magazine in the obituary talks about how Machen was willing to travel hundreds and hundreds of miles just to meet with a small group of students.
Yeah.
As we think about Machen, we just need to remember his, you know, great passion to help students and to, you know, provide spiritual encouragement and to help them grow, you know, their Christian minds in a way that they can, you know, deal with some of the assaults that they were facing or some of the challenges that they were facing. So,
yeah, that has always fascinated me too, especially, and it's not necessarily easy to get to these places either. It's not as if Machen's got a private jet and he just jumps on and shows up at the student group at the University of Minnesota.
Yeah, yeah.
I recall in the biography of E.J. Young, written by his son Davis, he just recounts how all these guys, early faculty members at Westminster, are traveling the country. But a lot of times they're driving across country in these old cars, and, you know, we don't have the modern quality anymore. They were built like tanks, you know, in terms of their structure, but he'd have to stop, you know, on a trip from Philadelphia to California and back. I think he ended up changing 7 flat tires or something. And it's just, you don't think about that, but that's in many ways the lengths that they were willing to go to connect with people, to advance the confessional and conservative cause, and to engage in this ministry. And at least to my knowledge, I haven't read a majority of it, but you don't find in their correspondence them, you know, trying to come up or negotiating fees for, you know, how much they're going to get paid to to make it worth their while to get somewhere. This is just something they did.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the scholars that were involved in the organization and the other elite leaders, I think they really accomplished some really wonderful things. And I believe it deserves to be remembered. And in my own, personal case, I wrote a biography of John Gerstner, and John Gerstner's mentor, John Orr, who is a professor of Bible at Westminster College in Pennsylvania, he was involved in the organization and spoke at a national convention in Philadelphia, where Machen also spoke. So there's, just a history there that's really rich and deserves, deserves our attention.
So big picture, there to connect back to Gerstner and Xenia, Kyle here. What's going on with the Presbyterians in Pittsburgh? What's in the is there something in the water? What I mean in a good sense. Like we've got such a rich history there. I'm curious if what might account for it.
Yeah, I think the United Presbyterian tradition, was a fairly orthodox denomination, and the people involved in it were some of them were really receptive, to what Machen was trying to do, and really agreed with his critique of liberalism and how destructive it was for the church. So you had a lot of sympathy in the United Presbyterian Church for Machen. I think that continued on, and Addison Leach, who was the president of Pitt Xenia in the 40s, he wanted to make it more conservative, and so that's why he hired, John Gerstner. So then, the Pitt Xenia faculty was just moving in a much more conservative direction, and I think the PCUSA was worried about that. They did not want to have another Fuller Seminary, situation in Pittsburgh, and so they moved, to try to merge the denominations because they were very concerned about what was going on at Pitt Xenia in the 1950s and their support for a more conservative, evangelical theological, position, and really a position that agreed with Machen's book, Christianity and Liberalism.
We're coming up on the 100th anniversary of that book next year. And
Yes.
it's really, really amazing to see how the Lord used that and continues to, because when we read that book today, you still feel as if it was just written.
Yeah.
Because we don't encounter modernism, and classical modernism, maybe has gone through many permutations, but at root, it's we still encounter the same theological challenges. And need to be thankful, and I think remember the lessons of the past that were learned by and taught by folks like Melvin Gove Kyle and J. Gresham Machen. But it's just a good reminder that all this, even though we're studying history that's 100 years old, this stuff doesn't get stale when we actually get to the bottom of it and understand the significance of it.
Yeah.
That's the value of history. So where do you
Yeah,
think
I mean,
we
church
oh,
history is really, really important for us. And I think, I think if we're going to move forward, we have to understand, our past. And so Christians, we need to constantly be, looking at our history and what we can learn, from it.
What outstanding questions do you think are there on this topic? Is there anything else, any other threads you'd like to pull on, in future works? Are there any leads you might share with maybe young or even seasoned scholars where you think, oh, it'd be interesting if someone dove into X, Y, or Z? What remains to be learned?
Yeah, that's a good question. I need to think about that a little bit more. I think, yeah, there's so much here. I think, just in terms of the evangelical leaders of the next generation, the conservative Protestant leaders of the next generation. I think it was, one OPC leader that came out of this, or who was involved in this group, was Galbraith,
Oh, sure.
who
Mr.
was a student,
OPC.
from Muskingum College, and so I delved into that. Who was the faculty mentor there, and what happened to that professor? And so I, you know, tracked that down, and that guy actually became a president of Sterling College in Kansas, and really helped, you know, solidify the Christian commitment of that college. And so I, you know, I guess maybe in terms of this paper, maybe tracking down, you know, some more of these individuals and what they accomplished, and but
you know, yeah, there's the studies of. Go ahead. We got to get into the archives. That's the difficult work, people, but there's work out there. So, I mean, the fact that there were several chapters might be interesting for people. If you're spread out there, you might not think you have access to any of the archives or resources that would be interesting, but I imagine that some of these resources might exist at churches in your area, or maybe, I don't know, universities in your area, if they have had League of Evangelical Student chapters. You never know. There could be a treasure hidden under your nose. You can dig in there and take a look. That's interesting. What do you got cooking? You have any other projects or books or articles that you're either reading and studying or working on writing yourself?
Well, I'm working on a paper on Wilbur Moorhead Smith, and he was a friend of Machen's and a Presbyterian pastor, and pastor in Ocean City, Maryland, and then also in Baltimore, and was a real bibliophile, and then became a professor at Moody, and then the first professor hired by Fuller Seminary, and just kind of felt that he's been a neglected, you know, figure, and so I'm trying to finish a paper on him. I have it finished, but I'm trying to redo parts of it and things. But
yeah, you're gonna take that around, and maybe we can see that in a journal sometime soon.
Yeah, hopefully. Hopefully we'll get it published.
Well, we'll get there. We're gonna start the campaign right now, so we're gonna make sure we find a home for that so we can read it. That's really exciting. And is there anything in store for the Presbyterian Scholars Conference next year, or just continuing on in the good course that you've already set?
Yeah, we have, you know, a lot of people that want to come back. We have I've received emails from some different professors who weren't there that want to be there. Mm. I do think maybe a panel discussion on Machen's book Christianity and Liberalism and its influence and legacy, I think, would be, you know, very, very appropriate. So yeah, we'd love to, anyone that would like to come, you know, just contact me, and we'd love to have you, you know, participate.
Exciting. I really appreciate it. And again, the article that we were have been talking about today is Advancing the Evangelical Mind, Melvin Grove Kyle, J. Gresham Machen, and the League of Evangelical Students. It's published in Religions, an open access journal. We've got a link to that in the episode description. You can get it. And it's written by our guest today, Jeffrey S. McDonald. Jeff, thanks so much for joining me today and speaking about this. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Camden. And thanks for all you do. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for that. That's very kind. And we wanted to point people to all the necessary places online. We'll have links available in the episode description, as well as to our previous conversation with Jeff on his book on John Gerstner. And you can also find information about everything we're up to, including all of our online video courses we make available for free, our publications, and other podcasts and programs. But I do want to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.